Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why did the era of federal prohibition last a mere 13 years, and what lasting effect did it have on crime, health, and social welfare in the United States? When the 18th Amendment to the Constitution and later the Volstead Act were passed in 1919, temperance crusaders rejoiced, convinced that the country's long-lamented problems with alcohol abuse would be a thing of the past. But those activists had not expected the new laws to be immediately and regularly violated by U.S. drinkers, or that they would create an irresistible market for outlaws, happy to capitalize on the undiminished American thirst for contraband liquor, wine, and beer. Journalist Karen Blumenthal is author of the new book Bootleg, Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. Her book Mr. Sam, How Sam Walton Built Walmart and Became America's Richest Man is also out this month. Karen, congratulations, I should say, and welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, it's interesting that you write the Prohibition book for a young audience because one of the primary justifications for getting rid of alcohol in this country was the effect that drinking was having on kids.
Right. And that was one of the things that really interested me. When I started with this idea, I was taken with the idea that maybe we hadn't done such a good idea. We hadn't done such a good job in talking about drinking with young people. Mm-hmm. And then I started to research the history. And in fact, we have 150 years of not doing a very good job of talking about drinking with young people. But we had this one point in time where we really tried to make a difference. And instead of a, you know, better, more moral America, we ended up with this complete disaster.
You make it clear that Americans have always liked their alcohol and that at a certain point in our history, even children were regularly given things like weak beer to drink. But part of that was because clean water was hard to find. Milk was hard to find. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, if you go back to our nation's founding, you know, people came over to America with lots of liquor and beer in the ports or the holds of the ship. That was a very important part of their daily lives. By the early 1830s, the consumption of alcohol in the United States was enormous. Abraham Lincoln talked in a speech about it being the first thing you drank as a baby and the last thing you drank before you passed away. It was very much a part of daily life. And even young people drank, you know, little bits of hard liquor even at several meals during the day, so much so that it became a real health concern. And that's really where we sort of start to date the temperance movement from this time in about the 1830s.
How did the temperance movement get wrapped up with the women's suffrage movement?
I found this to be one of the more fascinating things in my research. Women sort of cut their teeth politically on the temperance movement. This was their first concern. It became first an issue in families, and it was an issue in churches. And so they became concerned with that. Susan B. Anthony was a temperance worker initially. I think Elizabeth Cady Stanton was as well. And they moved from temperance to abolition and fought to end slavery, but then felt abandoned at that point. And, you know, black men got the vote, black women did not, white women did not. And they moved then towards suffrage and the right to vote. But the most powerful political entity for women in the early years was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the WCTU, which started out focusing on temperance and then began to focus on all kinds of things, from women's health to working conditions to child labor.
And I guess part of the reason, I mean, women and men have always consumed alcohol, but in different ways in this country. And this was at a time when the men were the ones who left the house and had a job. So if they became unable to work because of alcohol abuse, the entire family was affected.
Right. Or if they came home drunk and they were not pleasant in the house. But there were a lot of issues because in those times, the saloon was such a community center for men. And so in some places, they acted as the bank. So men came with their paycheck and the saloon cashed it. Well, guess what? They also left a lot of it there.
Yeah.
That was a huge issue for the family, too. If dad didn't come home with the paycheck, if he drank a good part of it or even some of it. So it became a family issue in that way. But there always was also a way for the rest of the family to drink. There was kind of a side entrance, almost a takeout counter, if you will. Women went and got drinks and took them home. They bought them from pharmacies as medication. It's not like everybody didn't drink, but men in particular focused their social lives around these saloons, which became pretty unpleasant places. They were dirty. There was a lot of gambling. There might be other illicit things going on in the back room. They were not good, you know, shall we say, family-oriented entertainment.
So tell us about, there's a nice sort of Texas connection here with Morris Shepherd. Tell us about him.
Morris Shepherd is a fascinating guy. He was a senator for a number of years, one of the longest serving men in Congress. And he grew up in Texarkana, went to the University of Texas. And somewhere along the way, he was quite a great orator, even from the time he was very small. And somewhere along the way, he developed this very strong aversion to drinking. And he was very opposed to it. And when his father, who served in the House of Representatives, passed away, he ended up taking his father's seat. And he was only 27. He was very young looking. People made jokes about confusing him with the pages in the in the Congress and sending him on errands. But he was such an orator, you know, that everybody knew him when he stood up to speak. And he became the person, then ultimately he was elected to the Senate from Texas, and he became the person who introduced prohibition, the constitutional amendment to ban alcohol in the Senate. And he became known because he was so incredibly committed to this cause, and because he introduced it every year from 1913 until it passed in 1919. He became known as the father of national prohibition. And you know, he felt like he was very true to his Texas roots. He often came back to the state to lobby for anti-alcohol legislation, and even skip to the end, you know, when prohibition is shot down. He came and got a truck and stomped the whole state trying to stop people from approving the amendment that you know, the first do-over in our Constitution that allowed liquor to be sold again.
I was unaware until I read this book that by 1908, fully a third of the people in this country were living under some kind of temperance law, be it local or state. There wasn't yet federal law. Did those people start up sort of cottage criminal industries, or did they just cross state lines and get their booze?
Yeah, mostly they crossed state lines. They even had mail order in those days, if you can imagine. And that was a huge issue, too, because they would vote to go dry and then you know, they would just drive somewhere else or they would order it. And there was an effort by Congress not long after to stop mail order. And that didn't completely work. Actually, the law passed, but it was never enforced. And so people thought, oh, this is just, you know, something by a faction of people who are overzealous about this and it's not really going to happen. And they got sort of complacent about it. And they weren't paying attention to, I think, how intense it was when the first prohibition amendments were actually being proposed. And there were big rallies and things. A lot of people just didn't take it seriously. They didn't think it was possible, particularly in, you know, those big population centers in the Northeast, because they weren't down in the South and the West where a lot of the movement came up. And I think somebody describes it as a storm cloud coming up from the West and kind of hitting the East Coast. They were totally surprised. A lot of people were totally surprised when it happened.
Well, and it's worth reminding people, I think a lot of people assume that it would continue because in the early days, the fledgling United States government made a significant portion of its revenue by taxing the sale of alcohol.
Well, it was the first tax, in fact.
The Whiskey Rebellion.
The Whiskey Rebellion was the first fight over taxes, right, in the new fledgling country. You know, it was recognized by the early founding fathers that if you had to tax something, this was something you could actually maybe get away with. And it turns out, though, that, you know, farmers were using this. It was cheaper for them to convert their grains into alcohol than it was to take grains to market. They did better. So the farmers had a rebellion and fought this tax. You know, that's been a lifelong theme. I mean, how many times did we grow up watching cartoons where they were trying to outrun the revenuers?
Yeah, exactly.
And who were those revenuers? They were the guys collecting alcohol tax. Even long after Prohibition was over and new taxes were put on alcohol, there was, you know, there has been efforts to get away from the tax.
So what sort of political wrangling did it take to actually get the 18th Amendment passed?
Well, there were a few things that happened. One was this push that came from these towns and cities in the South and the West. But the other thing that happened was World War One, which was very significant. Anything that had anything to do with Germans and Germany became, quite unpleasant, or, you know, people fought that. The Patriots thought that was, if you did anything that was affiliated with Germans, well, Germans had brought us the beer. It was the German immigrants who had helped shift the country from a nation of hard drinkers to a nation of beer drinkers. And so the fight became between the brewers and, if you will, the Patriots or the citizens who were concerned about World War One. And that gave kind of the last impetus to get enough people in Congress to approve the 18th Amendment.
Of course, the 18th Amendment banned the sale and consumption of alcohol, but didn't put any penalties along with that. That has to come from a separate law.
Right. And that's where we get what was known as the Volstead Amendment, the Volstead Act. And during that time, people referred to prohibition as Volsteadism. It's a very well-known sort of term, although it's pretty much lost today. Andrew Volstead was a congressman from Minnesota, and he wrote this act. People thought, oh, well, so they're going to ban hard liquor, but we'll still have our wine. We'll still have at least near beer. No. I mean, his decision and the law that he wrote was basically nothing with any alcohol in it. I mean, even stuff like, you know, vanilla extract became, you know, a source of some interest because it had just enough alcohol that you could separate out. So this Volstead Act was much stricter than people anticipated. And even after it was passed Congress and it went to Woodrow Wilson for a signature, he vetoed the bill, partly because he thought it was just a little over the top. But Congress was so well stocked with these, you know, prohibition supporters that they almost immediately passed it over his veto.
And so this is all taking place in 1919. Everything's supposed to go into effect in 1920. What did people start to do to stockpile what still existed and to position themselves not to be dry, at least according to the federal laws?
Well, there were a lot of things that you could do because it was legal for you to own your own supply. Mm-hmm. So if you had wealth or you had the means to do it, you stocked up. You know, you bought bottles, you hid them in the basement, you got your own wine supply. You did what you could. In the days before prohibition went into effect in January of 1920, people were using every conceivable method of transportation, strollers, suitcases, you know, wheelbarrows, anything to get alcohol from wherever it was to their home. So you couldn't have it in the country club. You couldn't have it at the office or at a restaurant, but it could be in your home. So there was all of this movement of, you know, bottles and liquor, you know, to the house. Beer was tougher because, you know, beer is a little harder to store.
Yeah, it doesn't last that long.
Top came.
Yeah. Yeah, and people used to get their beer in buckets and take it home.
Right. No, in the early days, brewers would bring it in and families would send the kids even with pails. It was called rushing the growler, maybe because the little top made a growling noise as you brought it home, or maybe because if you spilled any, the person who bought it wouldn't be very happy with you. But there was that was a way a lot of families got it, was with these pails that they brought home the beer. So beer was a little tougher because it didn't keep in quite the same way as hard liquor. But people were determined to stockpile it. Of course, you know, if you didn't have the means, then you were pretty much out of luck.
Mm-hmm. And there were libraries that said, well, we're going to take all off the shelves, all books explaining how to make your own beer and wine.
Yeah, some of the libraries, they really debated that. How do you do it? And, you know, not surprisingly, a big moonshine business popped up. People began to experiment. One of the things in writing about this for young people, I really wanted to capture the role of young people in this whole process. And I was really surprised to find out how much they were brought into it. You know, stories by a New Yorker writer of his family when the beer ran out and his grandfather was so despondent that the whole family got together and they brewed beer in the basement. And every Monday they got together and bottled it. And it was his job to put it in the bottle and his mom added something and capped it. And it was a whole family affair.
Just working at the family store.
That's right.
My guest is journalist Karen Blumenthal. We're talking this hour about her new book, Bootleg, Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Karen Blumenthal. Her new book is called Bootleg: Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, obviously, with all these people scrambling to lay in a supply of alcoholic beverages, people who were inclined to make a significant profit from that were paying attention.
Oh, this was, you know, for certain elements of the population, for, say, the gangs who had just had, you know, gambling, this was like yeast to bread. I mean, what a gift the government had handed them. They had stopped the supply of something that was in great demand. So, you know, they took advantage of it. And they immediately started importing liquor from Canada, from overseas, from Europe, from, you know, through various ports. They brought it in. People would park the ships outside the East Coast, and, you know, rowboats and motorboats would go out and pick it up. So it began flowing over the borders that way. And then people began to realize they could make their own. And even members of Congress, you know, tried, you know, making a little something in the basement, whether it was wine or an alcohol from oranges. I mean, people found a way, as we are. We're very clever. They found a way to get what they wanted.
So before members of Congress could be taught, could be caught taking embarrassing photographs of themselves, they
right.
were caught drinking things they shouldn't be drinking. I thought it was an interesting story that even Morris Shepherd on his family ranch, it turned out not to be his equipment, but there was distillery equipment
right.
that he said belonged to a cousin or something.
Right. Well, that is, it was one of the, you know, those titillating news stories. Sounds sort of like some of the things today, you know, that just in months after Prohibition, a huge still was found on his property making quite a bit of moonshine. And it was later reported that it was not his, although, you know, people really saw the hypocrisy. And there was an enormous amount of hypocrisy, even in the White House. Alice Roosevelt talks about going to the White House and hearing the stories about alcohol and, you know, going upstairs and, in fact, finding a great deal of alcohol available, you know, in a certain area of the White House, sort of off limits to the regular folks, you know, to the people who attended parties or other events. So, you know, in America, it was very much like the upstairs and the downstairs in the White House. There was a part that was very dry and there was a part that was very wet.
So if you had enough money, there was no problem accessing what you wanted to drink.
If you had enough money or if you were willing to work with a particular element in society, you know, people did all kinds of things. One of the saddest stories I found, and I guess I just was not aware, thousands of people actually died drinking tainted alcohol, industrial alcohol. There was a particularly bad concoction called Jamaican ginger that a supplier, in an effort to, you know, sort of save some money, had switched an ingredient. And it was supposed to be supposed to have a very small amount for certain ailments. And people were drinking it in larger quantities, and it caused a kind of paralysis of the foot. Hmm. It caused your foot to sort of flop down. And it was not reversible. It turned out that that particular chemical was later used in nerve gases in World War II. It was particularly terrible, and some thousands of people, particularly in the Midwest, in the sort of Kansas, Missouri area, were afflicted with this Jake paralysis, it was called.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Preston in Dallas. Hi, Preston.
Howdy.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I wanted to ask, just like you were just talking about the kind of illicit forms, the less safe forms of alcohol that were sold during the Prohibition. Do you see any parallels between the prohibition of alcohol that occurred during the 18th Amendment and the prohibition of marijuana that's still lingers today?
Yeah, and you know, because I'm writing for young people, it's a question that I really hope, you know, young people will ask themselves. But I think the most telling thing about this whole story of prohibition, it's really is a giant civics lesson. You know, the people voted by voting in congressmen and senators, and then by approving this amendment, they voted for prohibition. And when it didn't work, they did, you know, for the one time in our history, they voted against it and changed the Constitution. And I think the lesson for marijuana and the whole question is, we're a democracy. What do the citizens want? And that's, you know, for anybody who's making the comparison and the parallel, you know, that's either, you know, depending on which side you're on, the challenge or the reality, that it's the choice of our democracy, what we choose to allow and what we don't.
Did Prohibition and the years leading up to it when people were taking these teetotaling pledges, did that change the social acceptability of drinking in public?
It changed the acceptability of drunkenness.
Mm-hmm.
The idea first was truly temperance, and then it became what we call it teetotaler, where the people who went to these temperance societies, and if they were a total temperance person, a teetotaler, then they didn't drink at all. And that's where that term comes from. I always thought it, has something to do with iced tea or something. but it changed the attitudes about total drunkenness. And so one of the things that you see coming out of the Prohibition era, for instance, and I don't get so much into this because it is for young people, is the whole development of the cocktail. The alcohol was so terrible and it was so bad tasting that's where we got all these concoctions that made
things some cherry juice
and, sweet and delicious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to hide this, horrible tasting stuff that might have been brewed, in somebody's backyard or not brewed, but, distilled in somebody's backyard or, out in the undeveloped areas of Georgia or, Texas.
And we have Prohibition to thank for NASCAR.
We have Prohibition, yes.
To thank or to criticize, depending on your position.
Right. So, the cars were really just getting going in the 20s. And ironically, Henry Ford, who, his cars were among easily the most popular on the road, was this incredibly intense Prohibition supporter. He was totally against any kind of alcohol use. And yet down the South, his cars were running moonshine into the big cities to supply all of the bars and saloons that had opened up. And so those guys became very good drivers. They learned to drive at night on bad roads and to drive fast and to avoid the police. And then when they got together on the weekends to race, they were very good at it. And so a number of the early NASCAR best drivers were people who had grown up learning how to drive to avoid, the Prohibition agents.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Martha in Plano. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Well, you kind of stole my thunder on the tea. We called them tea sippers. I went to Texas A&M, and we always called the University of Texas, we called them tea sippers. And I guess it's probably because of the gentleman, the senator, that started all of this, correct?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was a term off the name, but he was a University of Texas man, that's for sure.
Well, and also a funny story I forgot to tell the screener is that when I was really small, my grandparents lived on a dairy farm in Middle Tennessee, and they had three barns. And one of them in the back, we weren't allowed to go in, and it burnt down about every 3 years, so they put up a new barn. And my grandfather was making moonshine back there, and they both drank a shot of that every night before they went to bed, and they called it Angel's Kiss. And they lived to their late 90s. Low cholesterol, late fat pork and everything, and they had low cholesterol, no heart problems, and my mom said it was because of that moonshine, but we weren't ever allowed in the back up in that barn, but when you talk about it, it brings it all home to me because they'd be in their hundreds now, so that's about the right time.
It's a great story.
It is a great story. They must have been making some pretty good stuff. A lot of it was pretty bad. You wouldn't have wanted to try it, I don't think.
Now, even during Prohibition, if you had a doctor's prescription, you could get things made with alcohol?
Right. So the pharmacists had it. In fact, the pharmacists were one of the big, areas where alcohol was coming in. So you didn't just have to get a doctor's prescription. Sometimes the pharmacist would write the prescription for you. People bought and sold prescriptions. You can go actually on eBay and see jillions of Prohibition certificates. It was actually a formal formal treasury certificates that were used to get prescriptions for a pint of whiskey or various kinds of spirits. And the pharmacists were one of the people that had access to it. And they were selling it out the back door. And the other people who were selling it out the back door.
I know what you're going to say. It's my favorite story in the whole book.
Were the priests and the rabbis. Because there was an exemption for wine for religious purposes. And one of the funny stories to me was a rabbi in California who quits in anger after his congregation has grown from a few hundred to over 1,000 people because they were just too demanding. They just wanted too much wine. And there's even probably more of a backstory. I think he probably encouraged some of that for a while and then maybe decided that wasn't such a good idea. But even the clergy were under some pressure to help out with this problem of no wine.
There were reports from hospitals and public health officials that things were somewhat better.
Right. Well, initially it was hard to get, until the whole underground enterprise kicked in. Beer and wine and liquor were very difficult to come by. But that changed pretty quickly. And on the other hand, one of the long-term aspects we did see was that consumption of alcohol did drop dramatically in the 20s. And while it went back up a little bit, it stayed down for a number of decades. In fact, it was the 1970s, maybe even 1980s, before consumption of alcohol reached the levels it had been before Prohibition.
So let's talk a little bit about organized crime, because you have a lot in here about Al Capone. By the way, I didn't realize how very young he was.
I know. That was surprising to me, too, especially because I was writing for young people. Mm-hmm. He was only 19 when he got to Chicago, and he had already been in a mess of trouble. He'd killed people. He'd gotten in, you know, he'd gotten a scar on his face from a barroom fight. And he really kind of had to get out of New York. He had to kind of get out of town anyway because he was in trouble with another gang. And this was, you know, he landed just before Prohibition started. And boy, what a career that launched, you know. So here was a guy who was just about as bad as somebody could be. He tortured people. He murdered people at will. He was just cold-blooded. And yet he became this big hero because he did seem to be above the law. He did seem to be able to get away with whatever he wanted. And so he really reached this celebrity level that was very unusual for that time.
This also launched the career of Al Capone's brother, who took a different name for himself. But tell us about him.
Well, he took on the name of an actor that he had admired, and he'd earned the nickname Two Gun because it turns out, like his brother, he was very good with guns. But he worked as a law enforcement agent. He worked both as a federal agent on some Indian territories up in the Dakotas as well as in the Midwest. He had run away. He was the oldest child of the Capone family. He had run away when he was a young man and changed his name and ended up in law enforcement. Only later did the Fed sort of make the connection. He ran into some tough times, ended up going back to his brothers and getting some financial support. And then it was disclosed in the 40s that there was this law enforcement brother of the Capones who had led this different life. It was quite intriguing. And he may not have been such a great guy ultimately. In fact, he may have lost a job for stealing. But at least for a while, he was on the other side of the law.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ulysses, where Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Great show again.
Thanks.
You're amazing. You've done some wonderful research and reading, and the writer is spot on. You've taken three of the things I was going to talk about, but not one number one. That is the symbiotic relationship in between the income tax and the passing of the Volstead Act, because it was a conundrum for the Fed. Gosh, where's our money going to come from? And as soon as they was actually backing from the temperance movement for the income tax. Have a comment and have fun. Have a great day.
Thanks for your call.
Great. That's a great point. And in fact, you know, Prohibition is repealed in the depths of the Depression. And why? Partly because the argument is we need the money. Goodness gracious, if we can tax liquor again and we can have liquor again, then that will help us. And so, in fact, taxes were a sub-theme and have been a sub-theme for, you know, alcohol in this country almost since its founding.
How did or did the Valentine's Day Massacre really give weight to people's sense that they may have been unhappy with Prohibition, but suddenly it's creating all this violence that no one bargained for?
Right. I mean, I think it was just one of those turning points. It made huge headlines, you know, all across the world, of course. It was just horrific. You know, men just shot down in cold blood, their hands up in the air. Gruesome sight, dog left chained to the, you know, a car nearby, he's howling. Really a terrible situation. But there'd been things building. There'd been unhappiness. There'd been these people dying from alcohol poisoning. The prisons and the jails were filling up with people who had violated the laws.
It sounds so very familiar.
Doesn't it, though? And so, doesn't it? And so here is this just terrible, horrific issue. And it even went to the attention of Herbert Hoover, who had just been elected president. And people from Chicago came to him and said, you have got to do something. This has got to stop. And it wasn't just Chicago. Detroit had gangs. Ohio had gangs. Kansas City had gangs. This was a number of cities in the country, New York, that were wrestling with this problem that had been created by the opportunity of Prohibition.
Of course, the end of Prohibition didn't end organized crime in this country.
No, well, they were well established by then, right? They had already, and they had a bankroll. I mean, They would have just been, I think, little two-bit operations and stayed there had not it not been for that. But by then, you know, they were very sophisticated business people, really. So they just moved on to other enterprises that they could take advantage of, probably never as lucrative as alcohol was.
How surprising was it to people who were passionate on either side of this issue how quickly the 20th Amendment was passed?
Oh, nobody expected this to really happen. And, you know, it's one of those telling things about politics. When you feel really strongly on one side or the other, there's a total unwillingness to compromise. And there's a real belief that there might not have been prohibition had the prohibition advocates agreed to allow beer and wine. And there's some feeling that there might not have been total repeal if they had, again, only allowed beer and wine. Hmm. But nobody wanted to give on either side. And so this whole movement rolls forward. And, you know, you think about, from our perspective, the Depression and what happened in the late 20s and early 30s and how Roosevelt came into office. And you think it was all about jobs. But in fact, one of the biggest things at that convention was repeal. And that news, when he finally stood up and said he endorsed repeal, the convention stopped as people danced and cheered for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, what an amazing thought. That was the thing that so motivated people. But even then, poor Moore Shepherd, you know, he was certain it wasn't going to happen. And as soon as Congress put the proposal to the states to approve, it was just a matter of less than a year before prohibition was repealed.
By the way, what did legacy companies like Anheuser-Busch do during the years of prohibition?
Well, they complained a lot because other people were getting their business illegally. And that's true. But they had all this refrigeration. Mm-hmm. So they switched to dairy. They made ice cream. A number of brewers shut down, but a handful survived, and Anheuser-Busch is one of them.
Karen Blumenthal is my guest. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Bootleg, Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Karen Blumenthal. Her new book is called Bootleg, Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. Unrelated to that, but also out this month, is her other new book, Mr. Sam, How Sam Walton Built Walmart and Became America's Richest Man. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We have so many calls on the phone that we will go back to the phone lines right now. Let's speak with Ken in Wise County. Hey, Ken.
Good afternoon. The great show today. Both topics hit home with me. I spent 10 years in the intelligence field, but the first alcohol of a non-medicinal nature was made by my great uncle in Virginia and given to me by his nephew, my uncle, in North Carolina. And I've driven some of those moonshiner cars.
So this
believe
was,
me.
This was during the years of Prohibition.
They were. It was. It's just a great show today, and I have to have that book. Thank you very much.
Oh, I like that. You know, I have to add, one of the things that's interesting to me is there's very little for young people on this subject because there's some reluctance to talk about, you know, those experiences with moonshine and that kind of thing. But I think that's unfortunate because we don't really understand this period of history and how important it was.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is great about your work and about a lot of people now who are writing history for kids is that we're finding ways to tell the whole truth in an appropriate way. Whereas, you know, when you and I were kids, sometimes the history, if it was about a famous person, it was only the good things about that person. And that ultimately doesn't ring true. And it only captures so much of your attention.
Right. And it makes you cynical, which is not what we want our young people to be, at least not too much.
And you grow up and you think, oh, I didn't know that was part of the story.
Right. So I interviewed, interestingly, Justice John Paul Stevens in the Supreme Court. He had mentioned, you know, prohibition in a few decisions over the course of his career and his own personal kind of knowledge and experience with it. So I asked for an interview, and totally out of the blue, one summer morning, you know, I get a call. Justice Stevens is on the phone. And one of the things that he said was, you know, growing up, that he had heard that, you know, alcohol was terrible and it was the devil's way and that terrible things would happen to you. And he said it was sort of disappointing when he grew up and saw that wasn't the case at all. but, you know, we want to tell young people what the real story is and give them a chance to make sense of it, to use it to make sense of the bigger world.
1-800. By the way, before we get into taking more calls, there were people during Prohibition who were selling alcohol not only to children, but selling it out of the back of candy stores.
Oh, yeah. Lots of places that were very popular for illicit liquor. Funeral homes, very popular.
Really?
Candy stores, right. I mean, all kinds of places you wouldn't expect. And one of the sort of big controversies that happened that I write about a little bit was a case in Detroit where a young man who's 14 years old goes in a drunken rage and destroys somebody's property. And he goes on to talk about how he ended up at these, in Detroit they were called blind pigs, these speakeasies, we would call them in other parts of the country, where he was not just given booze, but encouraged, really strongly encouraged to drink it. And he ended up stopping going to school and drinking all the time. And an investigation found there were a number of them around high schools all around Detroit. And that wasn't just in Detroit. So, alcohol was widely available to young people, and that was a big concern. In fact, that was one of the things that propelled the end of Prohibition.
And the fact that it was so forbidden made it absolutely tantalizing to this brand new generation of very liberated young women who were not going to live like their mothers had lived.
Right. And so they were going to go out with the guys, and they were going to carry flasks in their you know, garters or in their pockets, and the young men were going to carry flasks because that's what made you cool, and drinking made you cool. And, you know, so there was this whole culture, cool, that idea of it being socially cool and, so you know, of it making the cover of the New Yorker magazine was not something that happened before Prohibition. It was something that happened during that time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Harold in Grand Prairie. Hi, Harold.
Hey, just wanted to let you know, down here in this bastion of Bible Belt hypocrisy in Baptist, Texas, my grandfather made beer down in Italy in the 20s for pipeliners and was fined a couple of times. Also, when beer was legal, I had an aunt who had a beer joint in Oak Cliff right across the street from the VA hospital, and her best customers were Baptist preachers here in good old Dallas, Texas. So I'd like for you to comment, please, on the role in the South, specifically in the Bible Belt, of issues of prohibition, just how, you know, how it was abused and what all was going on. And thanks for a great book.
Thanks so much. In fact, the South was one of the, you know, main parts of the country that helped bring us prohibition. They were some of the first states to adopt it. But that didn't mean there wasn't drinking, as we all know. And, you know, I actually got a big chuckle as I was finishing the book. You know, we had this vote in Dallas to allow beer and wine to be sold in, you know, local grocery stores. You know, the whole time I was writing the book, you couldn't buy beer in my neighborhood, but now you can. So I think that's interesting that even today we are feeling still the effects of our push and pull relationship with these beverages.
You said that alcohol use rates didn't really bounce all the way back until like the 1970s. Is there any indication that prohibition did reduce the percentage of alcoholics in this country?
You know, that's a harder question.
Yeah.
But it did change the approach and the attitude. So the attitude of the country going into prohibition was, we have a terrible social ill, and as a country, as a community, we're going to address it. And we came out of prohibition with a very different attitude, which is that it's now a matter of personal responsibility. If you have this problem with alcohol, if you're drinking too much, or that, you know, this is affecting your life. It's up to you to fix it. We as a community are not going to try and impose or enforce a bigger restriction. And that was really the attitude for generations until the 1980s. And we saw Mothers Against Drunk Drivers sort of come up, you know, out of this terrible tragedy of children getting killed by drunk drivers. And finally, there's this little bit of a pushback against that whole issue of it being totally about personal responsibility and saying we cannot have drunk drivers on the road. We have to be concerned about how old our children are when they drink. And that's where we ended up with what is still a very controversial decision, moving the drinking age to 21.
Yeah. And the question, I guess, is whether that really restricts anyone from wanting alcohol or if it makes it more tempting.
Or if we have a bigger problem. You know, there are some very bright people in this country, a former college president who tried to open the discussion about whether or not we had created a prohibition on college campuses that was creating binge drinking and alcohol poisoning and all kinds of other terrible things that go on college campuses today because of that raised drinking age and whether we should have a discussion about it. And when he got a number of college presidents, I think two summers ago, to sign a pledge saying it was worth a discussion, the public outrage was so enormous that they all pulled back. So, it's still a very difficult issue today, which is one of the reasons why I think it's an important issue for young people.
Do you think that outrage is hypocrisy, given that most people are aware that there is binge drinking and there is excessive drinking on, I would say, most college campuses in this country?
Oh, absolutely. It's a terrible problem. I don't know that it's hypocrisy. I think that we just don't really know how to address it. You know, we grew up, I grew up with, the Just Say No generation or, you know, we've all had
Nancy Reagan said not to do it.
Nancy Reagan said, don't do it. That worked really well, if I recall
what
I remember of it. The problem is that we've never found a really good way to educate our youth about how to properly address this subject and how to properly live with alcohol in a healthy way. And what I found most interesting is this goes back to the 1850s. There was concern about this that one of the things we didn't talk about, but in the early days, there were even people who changed the textbooks in the country to try and teach them that alcohol was just terrible and was going to kill you and all these horrible things were going to happen because they were so concerned about young people. So we still have work to do. And that's actually where I, you know, sort of came out at the end of this research and this process. That young people still have this problem to solve that we have. It's still quite large.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Travis in Fort Worth. Hello, Travis.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Karen. How are y'all doing?
Great, thanks.
Great. Well, hey, I wanted to call in. I found it very interesting. I worked in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, with the royal family for a year where they still have prohibition of alcohol, among other things. And to a certain extent, I found that prohibition, especially among the younger people that we keep talking about on the show, almost made it more tantalizing. The taboo nature of it made them almost seek it out more than they would have if it was available.
Hmm. I think that's an ongoing challenge.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we will speak with Vicki in Fort Worth. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I was just thinking of a previous caller who mentioned the parallel between prohibiting marijuana and alcohol and what happens in the aftermath. And also you alluded to the prisons being full of people who were violating the prohibition of alcohol laws and now the prohibition of marijuana laws. And I can't help but think of the parallel between the rise of the gangs in Chicago and New York and the rise of the drug cartels. And the fact that you mentioned that after the prohibition was ended, they were flush with money, and they were huge business enterprises that went on to do other illegal things.
Right. That's true. But, I keep going back to this issue. We're a democracy, so we get to vote. And I think that's the very important lesson for anybody of any age, but especially for young people. You know, people, the citizens of the United States approved prohibition, and they repealed it. And the question about marijuana is, where do we come down? And I think as a country, we've come down as keeping it illegal.
It's an interesting issue with marijuana because, there's always that slippery slope question. And it's, there are people who could maybe see the way clear to do something different with the marijuana laws. But then there are other drugs that, because they are also illegal, get grouped in with marijuana. You know, heroin and cocaine are very different substances than marijuana. And I'm not advocating for one or the other, but it is kind of hard to separate those.
Yeah, and it's all very complicated. People felt that way about beer and wine and hard liquor
yeah,
for the
yeah.
same reasons, right? and they all got lumped together. So thankfully, you know, that's what we have, people have to deal with that. Politicians and people have strong feelings on both sides who wrestle through those issues. But I do think it's very interesting because I think there are a lot of parallels that we have to sort of ask ourselves, where as a nation and as voting citizens do we come down?
I'm interested in your research process for this because in terms of the facts presented, the book is every bit as dense as something that might have been written, you know, specifically for adults. But you have the added challenge of finding pictures of kids that were involved in this and finding the perspective of younger people. Did that make things harder for you?
Well, one of the things about the whole subject is it's enormous. As you heard from the callers, everybody has a story, and every community has a story, and every history society has amazing documents and stuff. So I was overwhelmed by the material, and at some points in this process, it threatened to drown me. but I really worked hard to find young people's experiences, and that made it more fun and more interesting to me. And I thought it helped change the way the story is a different story than you'll read in an adult book because of that.
Mm-hmm. And talk for people who might be interested in picking this up. Do you have a target age range when you're writing?
Well, you know, I think I was thinking of maybe the 7th, 8th grader and up because of the nature of the subject matter. There are some people who would say high school, mm-hmm. Although I would much prefer that a young person read it before they're making drinking decisions, not after, you know, before that issue has come to them in a social sense. But I think one of the things about books for young people is they really should be able to be read by anybody. They're really for anybody who's new to a subject or who wants just a great story told. That's really how it should be. So that's my feeling.
It's funny that in your career, and you've done a lot of straight on journalism work as well, but you've written for young people about things that a lot of people find controversial. There's alcohol. There's the Walmart issue. In the other book you have out, you've written about personal finance. Is there something about your personality that you can just find a way to tackle the things that people don't talk to their own kids about?
Well, I don't know about that, but I have a lot of empathy for the smart young person who wants to know more about the world. I mean, that's, you know, I hope my books can be read by any young person, but I especially am thinking about those kids who are curious about the bigger world around them and want more information at their level. And so that's really who I'm aiming for. And I don't want to write what other people have done. So it's mm-hmm. more interesting to tackle subjects that are new.
And you are finding that publishers are open to these kinds of books, or how's the climate these days?
Well, the climate's not very good these days because library funding has been cut. Mm-hmm. These aren't books that are necessarily sold in a bookstore, unfortunately, and there aren't very many bookstores. And library funding has been cut something fierce, especially, I have to get on my soapbox for a second, especially ours here in Dallas, mm-hmm. has been cut something like 40% in the last 4 years. And so what gets cut? You've got to buy Twilight, you've got to buy Wimpy Kid. You know, you're going to buy less nonfiction. And that's the unfortunate thing. That means then it's harder for the publishers to publish it. So it's a concern of mine as a nonfiction writer, but I don't intend to stop because I just think it's such an important thing.
If we do want these books, we can find them online, certainly, though.
Absolutely. And hopefully you'll be able to find them here locally as well.
Karen Blumenthal is the author of the new book, Bootleg, Murder, Moonshine, and the Lawless Years of Prohibition. She's also got a new one out this month called Mr. Sam, How Sam Walton Built Walmart and Became America's Richest Man. Karen, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
So much fun. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.